last month, I explored the first two foundations of mindfulness about being present with the actual body, being present with the feeling tones through the lens of living with something that is always with you. And so I want to actually go into the third foundation of mindfulness and then the fourth. So the third is being mindful of the mind, and the fourth is being mindfulness of dhammas. And so let me see, if you were here the last time, you'll remember that the thing for me that is always in my life is stuttering. This is my condition that persists, and we all have at least one, right? And my stuttering and being with it and noticing how it affects me and so forth and so on has been my teacher. And when I say it's been my teacher, is that it brings me to the practice. And since it is ongoing, it has so many opportunities for me to practice. It's almost like the actual breath, right? Like we focus on the breath mainly because it is always with us. It is always here. It is always happening. And the breath is present. We're not breathing in the past. We can't breathe in the future. We only can breathe right here, right now. So focusing on the breath brings us back to what is happening. Focusing on my stuttering brings me, especially when I'm stuttering, it brings me to that actual moment. And so it actually asks me in the moment, how is my practice going in that very moment? And what I've discovered is that these teachings, my practice, like just practicing practice in general, not practicing to do something, especially with my stuttering, but practicing in general, that these teachings are an extremely practical tool, if you will, for life. And I'll say for transforming my relationship to my stuttering, especially with something that doesn't go away. Okay? So just noticing how the practice has enabled me to be with something that does not go away. So this evening, I want to move more into noticing the mind. Venerable Ananda, who is a scholar, and actually did his PhD on the Satipatthana, which is what this is all about, he has a very good, it's called a simile on noticing the actual mind. It's like a snowball at the top of the hill. And if you can catch the snowball at the top of the hill before it starts sliding down, that's noticing the actual mind, right? So noticing it before it starts going downhill, because once a snowball starts going down the hill, it starts to go faster, it gets fatter, it's slipperier, all things happen. And if you're thinking of your mind in that sense, or just thoughts in general, like once they're sliding down that hill and it's bringing up momentum, it's faster, it's wetter, it's slipperier, all those things are happening, we have a less of a chance of catching the thoughts because of the momentum. So for me, when I think about, in retrospect, my thoughts around stuttering, and that I will actually share those. And then in the fourth, the foundation of mindfulness, I will just surely focus on one of them, and that's the actual hindrances. There's actually five, I think. I'm gonna have to look at. But working with the hindrances with my stuttering and how my stuttering hasn't changed, but just how the practice has changed how I live. Okay. So the main thrust of the third foundation of mindfulness, noticing the mind, is one question. How is the mind? You just ask that question at any time. How is the mind? So whatever may be happening outside of us and our thinking, which is where our attention usually goes, we turn it and we say we have a reflection of the mind. There's a mirror of the mind. It's almost like you're driving and you're looking through the rear view mirror. You think of that as looking at your actual mind. Like, what is the mind thinking right now? Like, what is going on? How is it? What is the state of it? Is there actual or whatever agitation in the actual mind? Is there some type of, like, for instance, restlessness, or is there like boredom? Like, just like, what? How is it? So that's kind of the chief question here. And I do think that using the actual assembly around the snowball helps me to know, like, where am I stepping in? Where is my attention attending to the mind? Is that the snowball? Is it at the actual top of the hill? Is it at the middle of the hill? Or is it like all the way at the actual bottom? Which it doesn't mean that, it just makes it harder to actually notice things. So this is why we practice noticing the state of the mind. We're training ourselves to catch the snowball at the top of the hill. Right? We want to see if there is desire, that's wanting something to be a certain way. If there is aversion, wanting something that's already there to not be there. Or is there distraction? You know, like if we notice it at the top of the hill, it's just starting to form before it will pick up momentum. So again, just how is the mind? The Buddha had a very interesting practice around how is the mind. There's a sutta where the Buddha describes how he was practicing before his awakening, that he would divide his thoughts into two groups and notice how these thoughts led to harm, right? And which thoughts led to well-being. So as the sutta goes, this is before his awakening, while he was still a bodhisattva, the Buddha set the harmful thoughts to one side and thought about, okay, these thoughts are rooted in craving, they're rooted in ill will, they're rooted in harm, to one side. The other side, he placed wholesome thoughts, thoughts that he felt were rooted in, for example, renunciation and kindness and compassion, to one side. So for me, my example in these times might be something like while I'm driving. And if I'm thinking, ah, that person doesn't know how to drive, why are they so slow? Why can't they use their turn signal? You know, anything like that. Those thoughts would probably go over here into the harmful basket, you know, rooted in craving, me wanting them not to be doing what they are doing, or aversion, you know, still driving, maybe I have thoughts of, oh, that was nice of that person. They just let me merge in. Kindness thoughts, goodwill thoughts, they go over here. So as the Buddha practiced with diligence and resolution, when these harmful thoughts arose, he would reflect, this thought leads to my own affliction. It leads to others' affliction and to the affliction of both. These harmful thoughts obstruct wisdom and it causes difficulty and leads away from freedom. Through this recognition and investigation, the thought would subside. He wasn't forcing it to go away. He was simply clearly seeing what the thought was and what the thought led to. So in other words, he was noticing the conditionality of the thought itself. And I just want to pause here and say that there's something important about this teaching in that there's noticing, there's reflecting, and there's recognizing. It's like natural unfolding as the Buddha stays present with what is being revealed. Not fixing something, not to say this is thought is harmful, I'm going to change it, or I don't want to think that way anymore. I don't. It was the recognition and the noticing and the reflecting. So not trying to fix something, not trying to change something, but change something. But it was a natural unfolding process of what he was clearly seeing about the thought. Okay. So it became more clear about the effects of these actual thoughts. And with further investigation, he did the same thing with thoughts that were unwholesome. And something interesting happened with the thoughts that were unwholesome, is that as he noticed that they were unwholesome and leading to things that were actually harmful, he noticed an absence. He also noticed the absence of unwholesome thoughts. So as he was noticing unwholesome thoughts, he was also noticing the absence of unwholesome thoughts. Noticing when something is there is just as important as noticing when it's not there. When we notice that something is not there, when we notice that there isn't ill will, it deepens what is wholesome. There becomes this balancing thing that happens when we notice the absence of something. So when you're noticing that you are being kind, that's amazing, because it deepens it. When we notice there's an absence of, for example, ill will, we get to actually cultivate the wholesome. So the absence of unwholesome deepen the wholesome thoughts. And sometimes that's a tongue twister. So I was trying to make sure that the unwholesome part went with the right part of the sentence. So Venerable Anālio, who I actually mentioned earlier, he clearly acknowledges that the presence of a defilement is an indispensable prerequisite for us to know about something, to know about it. So if recognition is not there, if we're not noticing, then the foundation for what is actually emerging in that moment is lacking. If we're not recognizing, we're not noticing things. And equally important, recognizing the absence of something is very important. So, and that's what starts to actually help us to shift our thinking. So how this unfolded for me with my stuttering was very interesting, because as I had mentioned last month, I was, and I still am, to reasonable, I am a covert stutterer. So I'm someone who hides their stuttering. And since I hid my stuttering, and I still do sometimes, it's obvious that I hid it because of my thoughts, right? Because my thoughts were harmful about my own stuttering itself. And so I didn't want to feel what I was feeling, you know? I didn't want to feel what I was imagining that other people were thinking about me, right? I also didn't want to feel what I was thinking about others, okay? And so all of this not wanting to stutter, not wanting to feel, not wanting to think what I was thinking, not wanting to think about what I thought others were actually thinking, caused me to not pay attention to my thoughts, because I was blocking everything, right? And so being a covert stutterer actually felt as a, it was a, It's a protective mechanism, right? But here's the interesting thing. I really wasn't protected from my thoughts. I really wasn't, right? It took me a long time to really hear my thoughts, to like slow it down enough where I can hear them. Because thoughts are so habitual. They are like so fast. They're lightning fast and they happen so actually quickly that the practice, just practice helped me let me see how I want to say this. It helped the slowing down of my thoughts. And with the slowing down of my thoughts, I could see them. And with the slowing down of them and I could see them, I could see how harmful that they were. So the third foundation, how is the mind, was the foundation that helped me to slow down this habitual process that was happening. So generally speaking, this is what my thoughts were like. So years ago, my thoughts were, I know this person thinks I don't know what I'm talking about. Or I would think, I know that they think I'm not intelligent. So when I'm stuttering, this is my thoughts. I know what they're thinking. They're thinking I don't know what I'm talking about. If I'm stuttering on my name, they were most likely thinking she doesn't even know her name. You know, these are my thoughts, and sometimes people would actually say that out loud. So that was most of my life. I know that this person thinks I don't know what I'm talking about, or I know that this person thinks I'm not intelligent. Something like that. That was for a long time. As I reflect back, my thoughts kind of shifted to something like, okay, I may not really know what they're thinking, but I'm sure I know what they're thinking. I'm positive I know. I may not know, but I think I'm pretty damn close to thinking, you know, I'm pretty sure. Do you see the struggle in that? that actual strife, that actual friction, that striving between I'm not really sure, but yeah, yes, I am. Right? Eventually, it got to the point where my thoughts were, wait a minute, I truly have no idea what this person is thinking. I truly do not. I have no idea. They may be thinking many things, and the things that they're thinking may not even have anything to do with me. That moment of I truly, and I felt it in my body, that I truly do not know what another person is thinking was freedom. It really opened up and just relaxed everything. And so this is what the third foundation teaches us. Instead of focusing on the objects, I wasn't focusing on my stuttering, I was focusing on my thinking. So I was looking through the rearview mirror of my mind. What is my mind? Like, how is the mind? You know? And that moment when I truly had, I mean, we use this phrase that it's like an actual light bulb moment. It was more than a light bulb moment. It was an opening. Like, it was almost like, thank goodness I really don't know what they're thinking, you know, versus trying to be sure that I actually knew. I found that my mind was filled with assumptions, it was filled with stories, it was filled with narratives, most of them harmful to me, because here's the thing, what I was thinking, the other person couldn't hear it, right? Only I could hear it. So my thoughts were harmful to me. They were also harmful to how I was approaching other people. You know, I would approach other people with more the trepidation, you know. I still do, but it isn't as much as before, right? So again, trying to catch that snowball at the top of the hill versus when it's already sliding down, right? When I noticed that I truly didn't know what the other person was thinking, that was when I was noticing the absence of harmful thoughts. As we notice the absence, so there are times when I'm stuttering when there is no story, there is no judgment, there's no assumption about what others are thinking. There's just stuttering. It's just the actual thing that's happening in the moment, along with my breathing, the fact that I can feel my feet on the floor, that I can hear the wind outside. Stuttering is something else that is just happening. And in those moments, there is true freedom. And that's what the actual practice can offer us. Again, as I've stated before, it isn't to say that I'm using mindfulness in this way. It is I'm noticing how mindfulness has changed my relationship over the years. It's very reflective. It's very to like look back and actually see. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is called the mindfulness of dhammas. It's often translated as mental qualities, right? Or maybe the categories of experiences. This foundation includes several lists. And if you've been in Buddhism for a while, you know there's lists upon lists upon lists upon lists. And so just to say, there's one, two, three, four, there's in this, one, two, three, four, there's five lists. And each list is a list of lists. So in the mindfulness of dhammas, there are 32 actual topics, because each list has about five or six or seven things in them. I'm only going to talk about one. Isn't that good? Thank you. So I'll just actually focus on the five actual hindrances, because this is where my practice with stuttering has taught me the most. Okay. So the Buddha used a very, what I think is a cool assembly around the five hindrances. He used bowls of water, right? And so the first one, if you think about a bowl of water, when it's still, it's not moving, it's clear, you can look into that bowl and you can see your reflection very, very clearly. So that's without an actual hindrance. And a hindrance is something that it will actually get in the way, it's going to whatever, interfere. And the Buddha talked about these hindrances as things that can interfere with our practice, but he also talked about them as things that would interfere outside of our practice as well. So just very quickly, these five bowls of water. So the first actual hindrance is around sense and desires. It's wanting things. Okay? And so you imagine what he shares, that a bowl of water, and it has in it, it's mixed with dyes, with actual, or whatever. And so maybe it looks red, or it looks yellow, or it looks green, or it looks blue. When you look into the water, you can't see yourself, you see the dye. So there's something that is interfering with you to actually seeing clearly. And since you can't see your reflection, the mind is caught in craving, is caught in wanting. Right? It is unable to see things as they really are. There is a film of wanting in front of your mind. The second one is ill will. And what he said with the bowl of water is that like ill will is like, for instance, resentment, aversion, anger, and that the bowl of water is like boiling, it's bubbling. And you can imagine you trying to see your own reflection in bubbling water, you actually can't, because it's just so actual fierce. And so that the mind is actually clouded with actual anger. The third, sloth and torpor. Those are interesting words. We don't use those words in modern day, but it's generally, it's often said as sleepiness, but the bowls of water for this are filled with, for example, algae and like water plants. So it's very kind of thick and slimy, and that's what sloth kind of feels like. It feels thick and slimy. Just, you really can't move, right? It's just this, It feels like sleepiness, but it's not quite it, but it's just slowing down of everything. Everything just slows way down. So you think that the mind is heavy with dullness. It's heavy with, like, for instance, drowsiness. The fourth is restlessness and worry. You think about the bowl of water being whipped around with wind. You think about water with wind, just like moving through it, just moving the actual water. It is making lots of ripples and waves. It isn't stable. And that's what the mind is like when it's very, very restless. There is anxiety, there is agitation in the mind. And the fifth one is doubt. And for doubt, he said that the bowl of water is in a dark room, that no light reaches it. That even if the water is clear, you still can't see your reflection in the darkness. Right. The mind is actually paralyzed with uncertainty and skepticism. When the clear bowl of water is still transparent and is placed in good light, you can easily see your reflection. The mind is calm, the mind is clear, and it is unhindered by the five the five hindrances. And here's the thing that I reflect on is that I think we are the water. We are the bowls of water. And that the hindrances, the dye or the heat or the algae or the wind or the darkness, are added layers over our mind. They are temporary states. They are not permanent. They are not who we are. So, with my stuttering and these hindrances, you can imagine all of them weren't always there, but definitely aversion was there. For years, the dominant hindrance related to my stuttering was ill will. It was deep aversion to the experience of stuttering itself. Right? Every time I felt a block to actually what was coming up, there was this immediate wanting it to not be there. No, not this, not now. I don't want this. The mind was like boiling water. It was so agitated with resistance all of the time that I really couldn't see clearly about what was happening. I just didn't want whatever was happening. I didn't want it to be happening. I was fighting my stutter even before it fully emerged. So stuttering is a neurological, it's like a malfunctioning. They don't know exactly where it shows up in the brain, because our speech happens in multiple parts of the brain. But they do know that it's neurological. And so when I'm talking, I can often know maybe the third or the second word I'm getting ready to say, I will likely stutter on it. And so the aversion would happen. So what I am trying to say here is that the aversion would happen before I would even stutter, because the word hadn't come yet, but I had a pretty good idea that in that one word that I wanted to say, I would likely stutter on it. So the aversion would happen before the stuttering. That's how strong it was. That's how strong the resistance was. And so that just made everything worse. So I would stop myself from talking because I was getting ready to stutter, not because I was stuttering, which caused the actual upward tension in my body, which caused the block that I was having to actually last longer. So this aversion, I was stopping myself before I was really stuttering. The flip side of aversion is actual clinging. So there were moments, obviously, when I wasn't stuttering. And in the stuttering world, people who don't stutter, they are called fluent speakers. And so when I had fluency, I would cling to the fluency. Oh yeah, I'm not stuttering right now. Oh yeah, I wanted that I wanted the non-stuttering, I wanted the fluency to last longer. So I would be clinging to actual fluency and pushing away stuttering. And so again, it's just kind of this thing of like noticing the aversion of even before something was truly actually happening. The other hindrance that was big for me and it still is restlessness and worry. It showed up in that, what if I stutter on this word? What if I stutter with this person? Should I change it? So people who stutter sometimes do what is called, we will switch out words constantly. And people who stutter generally have a fairly decent vocabulary because we're always changing words. And so it's this thinking of, should I change that word that I'm getting ready to actually stutter on? And then it's like, how might changing the word actually change the sentence, change the meaning of what I was actually saying? So I had to kind of weigh the risk between not stuttering and switching the word and maybe not getting across the meaning that I truly wanted to actually get across. Right? However, if it held the stuttering at bay, maybe it's worth it. So the practice became, can I notice the worrying without getting swept up in it? Can I see that the mind is restless without needing to act on every anxious thought? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But it definitely had an actual impact on the things that I would do in my life. For example, I spent years when I didn't go through a drive-through. Wouldn't do it. No way. I'm not going to talk into some into some actual box where the other person can't see me struggling. I'm not going to do that. Restlessness and worry. You know, how is it that I would show up in the world? The last one that affected me was doubt. And the doubt was around whether I had anything worth saying. Was it easier just to be quiet? Was it easier just to not talk? And oftentimes that's exactly what I did. I would start talking, I would feel the stutter, and I would just stop. Like, done. I'm just not going to do it. You know? There was doubt about whether people would take me seriously. Because also what happens, stuttering isn't expected. And so folks react the way that they actually do, you know, sometimes. Yeah, so it was just my thinking that, well, maybe it's just not worth it. So for me, with doubt, the bowl of water was stuck in a dark room. No light could even actually reach it. Right? I would just stop talking. Joseph Goldstein says that doubt is the hardest of the hindrances to see. Doubt is the hardest one to see. And Sharon Salzberg says that doubt is very difficult to hear because doubt doesn't sound like doubt. Doubt sounds like the best idea you've had all day. It doesn't sound like doubt. Okay. But then there's the absence of the hindrances, you know, kind of noticing that there were moments more recently where there's less worry, there's less doubt. There's just clear water. It's just me. Right? That is allowing the stutter to unfold. I remember going on retreat years ago, and one of the meditation teachers said, he said, try not to think about it as that you stutter. Try to think of it that the body stutters. This is what the body's doing. The body is stuttering. And so that was also a way for me to not be so attached, therefore not be so actual adverse, therefore not wanting to cling as much. So what has changed through this actual practice of the four foundations of mindfulness is that, yes, I still stutter, you know, and I still generally don't like it, you know. I still generally wish that I didn't stutter, you know. I don't hate it. Right? And what's really interesting is that what people think when I stutter, because my speech pattern isn't quite the same as most people, people generally think I'm being very thoughtful. And I am a thoughtful person. Okay? However, It is also my stuttering that is happening at the same time, right? So it has definitely changed my relationship to my studies. It's changed my relationship to my own mind, really, really. It has transformed in ways that I could not have imagined. I think that this is the beauty and the promise, if you will, if you like that word, of our practice, that when we practice, things unfold and we just don't do, we have no idea of the outcome. We almost kind of like let go, you know? So these are I think are the gifts of things that are in our lives that actually persist. If you have something in your life that is persisting over time, it gives you the opportunity to practice. It gives you the opportunity to practice. And just knowing that this is a gradual path. I mean, I had no idea years ago that looking back, I would see my stuttering in this way. You know? So my invite you to just practice, to bring these actual the foundations of whatever is happening in your actual life to everything. How is the body? How is the feeling tone? How is the mind? How are the mental qualities? What are those mental actual qualities that are at present? The Buddha taught these foundations not as theory, but as practice. So we practice with them and we trust the process. We trust that the transformation happens not through striving, right? But through gentle and patient and kind attention to just what is. And I thank you so much. Thank you for practicing with me.